Today is Monday, February 5th, 2007. My name is Sandy Fehler, and I'm an interviewer with the University of Wisconsin-Madison Oral History Project. Today, I am interviewing Douglas Zweitzig, Professor Emeritus with the UW-Madison School of Library and Information Studies. Dr. Zweitzig retired from the university in 2000 after 18 years of service. Hello.
Hello.
I
should probably apologize for the lingering effects of a cold.
That's all right. And any time we have to stop, just let me know if you
sure.
need to get some water or anything. In fact, I should have brought some. I'm sorry, but I can get some if you need it.
Fine.
Right. We're going to start the interview by asking you to talk about your childhood and also where and when you were born, where you went to elementary school, high school. Were there any people in your early life that had an influence on you in your career decisions?
Okay. I was born in 1938 in York, Pennsylvania. My father was a minister, and his entire career was in Pennsylvania, but we moved about every 7 years. So I'm not going to remember. When I was quite young, we moved to Greensburg, and that's where I entered elementary school, but I'm not going to remember the name of it.
And that's Pennsylvania?
Greensburg, Pennsylvania, mm-hmm. Yeah. And when I was going into third grade, we moved to Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, again for 7 years, and then to Allentown, mm-hmm. where I finished the last 2 years of high school, and graduated in 1956. I don't know if I hit all the points.
Did you have any brothers and sisters?
Yeah, I did. I had one of each.
Uh-huh.
I had an older brother and a younger sister.
Okay. Did you like school?
I was not gripped by school. It was okay, and I did okay.
Mm-hmm.
But it wasn't like, I was born for it or anything like that. In terms of early influences, mm-hmm. a critical influence was surprisingly from an aunt, my mother's sister, who was a librarian. And she had a lifelong companion who was also a librarian. My aunt was at Johns Hopkins in the history department for, I think, her entire career. Toward the end of her career, she was pulled the Department of Libraries into a central library, and she was placed in reference, may even have been head of the department before retiring. And my other aunt worked at Enoch Pratt, our honorary aunt,
mm-hmm.
For her entire career, and was head of the popular library there, and which was a key feature of the services there.
Sure.
So I was aware of that. I hadn't really thought about being a librarian as a career, but that was kind of a model for me, and when I became a librarian, of course, they were thrilled. And unlike me, after retirement, they continued to get ALA publications and read them all until their deaths, and particularly would be looking for any mention of me in these publications.
Sure.
So that's an appropriate early influence.
Now, what level of education did your parents have?
My mother had some graduate study in math. I think eventually she completed a master's degree because she was teaching after we were in school.
Mm-hmm.
My father had a theology degree from Yale,
mm-hmm.
and eventually an honorary doctorate from his school, Franklin and Marshall University in Lancaster, Pennsylvania.
And was it a given that you were going on to college?
Oh, I think it was, mm-hmm. yes.
Then how did you pick your college?
Somewhat indolently. there wasn't a program in the high school that organized that for me. And my parents and I didn't talk about it all that much. I ended up going to Lafayette College in eastern Pennsylvania. I'd also been admitted to Princeton, but Lafayette offered me a scholarship, and that made a big difference. Princeton would have been waiting at tables in the dining hall.
Is that a liberal arts college?
Yeah, mm-hmm. In eastern Pennsylvania.
Mm-hmm.
At the time, I think about 1,500, and now I think it's around 5,000.
Oh, okay. And did you know when you entered college what field you wanted to go into, or were you really there because it was a liberal arts college and you wanted that kind of education?
I knew that I wanted to go into a combination of psychology and philosophy. It didn't exist. I ended up being an English major. But I liked a number of courses. I liked economics. But the English major for me was kind of the richest experience because of the variety of reading. Mm-hmm. And so I graduated in 1960 with that and went on to Harvard for a master's degree.
In English?
In English. Mm-hmm. And didn't do well enough at Harvard to stay for a PhD. And from there began teaching at the University of New Hampshire in the English department. And at that time, in order to gain tenure, you had to be working on a PhD degree. Different times.
Uh-huh.
And I didn't want to go on for a PhD degree, so I worked there 3 years. But there was going to need to be a review and, you know, what are your plans and so on.
Sure.
So I was looking around at that point. And there was a reference librarian at the university library, a man by the name of Hugh Pritchard, who kind of made it a practice to have an eye out for people who might be attracted to library science. Hmm. And I've talked to others that he recruited. That's why I mention him.
Mm-hmm.
And so he talked to me about this possibility, since I was thinking what I would do next. And that became attractive to me, and they actually hired me for the summer to work in the catalog department.
Oh, great.
To see how I would like it. And I did. Surprisingly enough, it's starting cataloging.
Yeah.
But I was so interested in the richness of the materials that were coming through that they went on to apply to Rutgers for their library program.
Uh-huh. And there, did you start with a master's, or did you go right through to
no,
the PhD?
No, I got a master's degree in library service.
Uh-huh.
from Rutgers.
Okay.
And went to work at Ohio State University in their English and Speech graduate reading room.
Okay, now describe your experience getting your master's degree at Rutgers. Was that a good program as far as you felt?
I did like it, actually. I know that's not a common reaction of students to library education, but I did enjoy it. I liked their emphasis on service, and that they called the degree a degree in library service, not mm-hmm. library science. I had a job in a public library, small public library in Middlesex, New Jersey. They were just starting a library, so there was the librarian and myself organizing, moving the collection at one point. And that gave me a lot of useful experience and kind of gave me a perspective on the education. So I was going to school full time, but working maybe 20 hours in the library.
But you chose your first job in a library, or your first job after your master's degree was in an academic institution.
Yeah, that's true.
And why was that?
It was a fluke.
Oh.
There was a woman in the library school, kind of like Barbara Arnold here, who was mm-hmm. responsible for working with library recruiters who would come to the school. And she nabbed me in the hall, and she said, "Nobody's talking to this person from Ohio State."
Huh.
And I said, "Well, I don't think I'm interested." And she said, "Well, why don't you just go in and practice?"
Huh.
And it turned out they had a position for their English and Speech graduate reading room. They had three such reading rooms in the main library, one in art, one in mathematics and philosophy, I think. It's been a while ago.
Mm-hmm.
They had a woman, just as an aside, they had a woman who had been there for some years. And students told me after I took the job, she was not popular any longer with the English department. It was, in fact, a political problem for the library, so they really needed to look for somebody. And someone with a master's from Harvard in English was very appealing to them.
Oh, yes.
The students told me that she had been there so long and had heard every question that anybody had, that when they would ask her a question, she would translate it into one of interest to her that she hadn't researched before, and she would go answer that question.
I see.
So she wasn't seen to be useful. A very bright woman, very accomplished woman, but, you know, she had grown out of the job.
Yeah.
And I was there 2 years. And the thing that moved me out of there was, I liked the job, and I certainly liked being the liaison with the English department.
Yeah, talk about what your responsibilities were in that position.
Well, it was a kind of reference reading room for graduate students was the purpose. So it would have, it was immediately adjacent to the stacks for the literary collections, mm-hmm. but in the reading room would be the reference works.
Okay.
And I was also then responsible for supporting their PhD program in training people to do research in English literature. And Richard Altick was one of the key professors there who taught that course. And I was led to understand that if I pleased him, then we were okay. You know, the library would be out of its political problems.
Uh-huh.
And he and I got along fine, so that was all right. Mm-hmm. And he taught a wonderful course in research methods for English PhD students.
Mm-hmm.
So it was building the collection. It was providing reference services mm-hmm. to graduate students, supervising a reading room. Mm-hmm. And it was a good fit for mm-hmm. me. I liked it.
Mm-hmm.
But I found that there were certain recurring problems that the library was dealing with and not solving very well. When I first got there, there was a big push because specialized materials would kind of gravitate into the room but really belonged in the stacks, that we should go through the files and get these materials back into the stacks.
Mm-hmm.
And so my first months were spent doing that, learning the collection. But then I looked into the files and I found that 3 years before they'd had the same panic, the same crisis with this material. And so that was an example of the kind of things that I saw coming up all the time. And they were caught up in these things which were management problems that could be solved. So that was part of my motivation for saying, I think I'd rather start working on that kind of problem than to be experiencing them over and over.
good decision. So then where did you go?
I went to Syracuse University.
Oh, at that point,
yeah.
To work or to go to school?
Well, I went to go to school. There was a graduate of Rutgers, Roger Greer, mm-hmm. who was a PhD graduate of Rutgers, and I'd met him at Rutgers. And he had gone to Syracuse and was the assistant dean there. And he kind of recruited me to come there for the PhD.
I see.
They were to have a PhD program on my arrival. It turned out they didn't.
Mm.
So the first year I was, technically adjunct professor, and the second year I was his assistant. Roger Greer became dean, and during that second year they developed their PhD program. Pauline,
now, I have to ask
yes?
you: were you a little concerned about that? Did you think at first you might have made a mistake, or were you? Or not? You were willing.
Well, it was an adjustment because suddenly I was teaching courses I
yeah.
hadn't really prepared to teach, and
mm-hmm.
and the standard again for teaching was not what it is today.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, to teach a course in library and society, I was handed a notebook that a previous instructor had used and told just read through the notebook kind of thing. And I taught that course, and I taught history of books in libraries, not very successfully, I didn't think, but. Got through the year,
sure.
and I could see why some students don't like library education. what had happened at Syracuse was that they had hired an interim dean who advertised himself as being part of the Manhattan Project. He was a physicist, and I don't recall the details of why he became the dean of the school, but the school had been a fairly traditional school, and he shook them up. And he got them excited about doing a PhD program and so on, but they didn't have the capability. And the image that occurred to me at the time was of an airplane running its engines on the runway with the brakes on.
Oh.
They were excited, but they weren't moving.
Oh dear.
and that was kind of the condition of the school when I got into it. Toward the end of that first year, Pauline Atherton, who later was known as Cochran,
right.
took the name Cochran, was on the faculty, and she had met a man named Miles Martin, who was from the communications school at Michigan State University. And he was an operations researcher, But she was so impressed with him and his concept of information and the importance of it, et cetera, that she brought him in, and the faculty hired him for the faculty, and he was given the job of designing a PhD program.
Oh.
And did.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was an exceptional program. And it was called a program in information transfer. And he was trying to be more conceptual and less operational about it.
So that was sort of out there, wasn't it?
It was kind of out there.
Compared to other schools.
Exciting to me.
Yeah.
And it was kind of fun to be on the faculty while he was doing this, knowing that I was planning to enter it.
Sure.
That fall. And so in the fall, I guess, of 69, I began that program. There were five students. And he recruited two of the young graduates of the Michigan State program that he thought were the kind of the brightest and best to be on the faculty. One was Brenda Durbin, who's since made quite a name for herself mm-hmm. as a communications researcher. Another was Jeff Katzer, who taught research methods and stayed at Syracuse until his death a few years ago, as in his 50s, I think. He was unfortunate. Kristen Eschenfelder, who's on the faculty now, was one of his students at Syracuse. Mm. And I know was very affected by his death, as, mm-hmm. as anybody who knew it, he was a special person. Mm. And they were the bright spots in the program for me. Miles was a fairly good but unorganized teacher, charismatic, but mm-hmm. But Brenda was tops, and Jeff Katzer also taught me a lot.
Mm-hmm.
So we had three themes in the program. One was on research methods, and one was on librarianship issues, and one was on more conceptual communication issues.
Mm-hmm.
And I finally wrote a dissertation under Brenda Durbin.
And what was that topic?
It was on adult use of public libraries. Mm-hmm. And what I had become interested in was effectiveness of libraries. How do you measure and promote effectiveness of libraries? Because libraries seem to have kind of momentum to them without a lot of thought about where is this going and how will we know when we get there.
Mm-hmm.
The dissertation on adult use of public libraries was to look at who actually uses libraries and maybe try to get a sense of why, what's motivating that. And the way that I finally summed it up in the dissertation, and Wayne Wiegand has since kind of caught on to this tagline that he uses now, is the importance of looking at the library in the life of the user as opposed to the user in the life of the library. And most of the previous studies had looked at users from the point of view of the library.
Mm-hmm.
How much do they circulate materials? As opposed to looking at the user's life more holistically and then looking at where does the library fit in the total picture.
Mm-hmm.
So I was looking at their general media use, the amount of book reading, their community involvement, educational level, trying to see what would explain who's likely to use public libraries more than others.
Mm-hmm.
You know, other things being equal, who are likely to be users of public libraries.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing that I was pleased by as an outcome of that was that the library user, high library user, was not a isolated book reader that's kind of the cliche view of the high library user,
mm-hmm.
but it was a person who was very high in information consumption generally. Not so much TV, but other print, and also very involved in the community, more gregarious than not, high in family involvement, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So the library was serving vital members of the community, not retiring yeah. members of the community.
Now, where did you get your subjects? Who did you?
It was a random survey of Syracuse households.
Mm-hmm.
And it was done in the summer of 72, perhaps. Sorry to be vague on
That's
the date.
Right.
But at any rate, whatever summer we were collecting, we collected the data during the week that was the hottest and most humid summer in Syracuse. So our response rate was lower, I think, for people's tolerance to take a telephone interview than we would have expected. But we did complete the number of interviews that we needed to complete.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And did you continue to teach while you were Working on your PhD?
No, because of federal fellowship program that allowed me to stop teaching entirely and to be full-time in studies.
Okay, well, that's nice.
Yeah, it was very nice. Right. So for 3 years, I was able to do that.
Okay. And then what? Did you know what you wanted to do?
No.
All right.
I mean, you know, I certainly knew what I was interested in.
Yeah.
But library schools weren't necessarily interested in what I was doing. For example, there was a dean who was looking for somebody in information science. He didn't know what that was, but he knew he needed to have somebody. This is early 70s. And he was looking to me for this. Well, you know, that wasn't me. He'd heard information transfer and thought maybe he was hungry for somebody.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't as if the library education world was just waiting for somebody like me. I had several possibilities, but the one I took was a position at Toledo. And the reason I did that was that Miles Martin, who had designed the PhD program at Syracuse, mm-hmm. had been brought to Toledo to design a program in community information services. They did not have an accredited library education program at the time, and they wanted to have one. And they asked him to come in, and the new standards of ALA allowed a specialized program. Didn't have to be a comprehensive library education program any longer.
Mm-hmm.
And so the idea was to propose the specialized library masters in community information services. And that appealed to me quite a lot, and I knew that he was capable of designing an innovative and functioning program.
Mm-hmm.
So even though the university wasn't at the tier that I would have hoped for, that intrigued me. So that's mm-hmm. where I went.
So what did you teach there?
That's a good question. I haven't thought about that in a long time. I taught a library and society type course, I know. I think I taught acquisitions. But it's been too long ago.
So, but when you got there, there was no library school, or
there
was just
there had
started?
Been an unaccredited program, mainly
okay,
training school librarians for the Toledo area.
I see.
As happens in a lot of
right.
places.
Right.
So he was there were, I think, two faculty that were still there that he in effect had to retool, mm-hmm. And he recruited me, and he recruited Terry Crowley, who. Had been at Illinois mm-hmm. and had developed a reputation for evaluation of reference services to the faculty. So there were five of us, and we had to create a curriculum and recruit a class and try to, you know, make this thing work. And
mm-hmm.
and one of the aspects that I liked a lot was that we had internships where our students were placed with government offices and local service organizations, and I don't mean the Lions, I'm sorry, service agencies,
mm-hmm.
And asked to be kind of information interns in those offices to try to see what materials they might need and how to organize the materials and make them more effective.
Mm.
So it was kind of like, what's it called now?
Practicum?
I'm thinking of the management information attention that gets looked at now.
Okay.
It's mm-hmm. an early and crude form
mm-hmm.
of that.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it was a very effective program. Miles turned out not to have the capability to close the deal in terms of getting accreditation.
Mm.
And toward the beginning of my third year there, it was clear we were spinning wheels there too. It was a
okay.
different image,
okay.
Different situation, but we weren't moving in the direction we needed to move, and my career therefore was not developing. And Brenda Durbin was out at that time University of Washington, and they had a position in the library school out there, and she encouraged me to apply for that.
Okay.
So that's how I ended up out there.
I see. And then how many years did you spend there?
I was 5 years there.
Okay.
So. And Brenda and I worked collaboratively on a research project that was looking at, because of the funding priorities, it was called Urban Information Needs. But it was really looking at how information functions in everyday lives of people. And so it kind of carried on from my dissertation in that way.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was important work, and Brenda continued to kind of work along those lines in the communication field. We tried to, there was a federally funded project, and we tried to encourage the Office of Education Library Programs Office to fund some training for librarians and what we learned, and they didn't get it. I remember one of their quotes was that if there are communication problems out in the Pacific Northwest, they ought to solve them out there. So they didn't get it, what we were about. And and so the library connection just kind of fell away on that.
So this was a faculty position. You were there as an assistant professor?
Yeah, as an assistant professor.
So you were right in the thick of teaching, research, publication, et cetera.
Right. I was brought out to teach the management course, which sounds like I've been a problem solver. It was a problem for them. And with my background, they thought that I would be good at teaching the management course. And the director, Peter Hyatt, gave me time off when I arrived to develop a course. And it was a required course for the students. And it was different for that library school to have a faculty member seriously working on research, particularly outside the school.
Really?
The collaborate, yeah. They prided themselves on having an open door policy for the faculty that they could be found in their offices at any time.
Oh, boy.
I know. it was a different world. And and that wasn't kind of a happy thing in terms of culturally in the school to have a faculty member who wasn't behaving like the rest of them.
I see. Yeah. But you were successful?
Well, I was successful in the research. It turned out that I think I got caught up in a political fight between the director of the school and the dean of the graduate school to whom the library school reported. They had been stuck underneath there for reasons lost in history. And so I went up for tenure a year early, and he turned it down.
The
head of the graduate school.
Oh, boy.
And I thought, well, you know, I don't feel secure here.
Yeah.
Because I had talked with him about this and told him what I was planning to do, and I accomplished it at that point, and thought this was a reasonable thing to ask. And it was complicated. He wouldn't give me a good accounting for what was going on. Brenda had been in communication with a researcher at a place called King Research Incorporated in Washington, D.C. That was probably the leading information consulting company, although it was not a large organization. And they learned that I was kind of thinking about alternatives at that point, and so they recruited me to work for them.
Oh.
So I went there in 1980.
Now, what was that job all about?
It was being a consultant, and I had done that kind of thing, so that wasn't a new skill set. It was an interesting company because they had not, to that date, made a profit, and so they seemed not to emphasize bringing in money a lot, which was fine with me, since they were paying me.
True.
But it turned out they couldn't sustain that, so I worked on a number of projects, one of which came to mind just the other day because there was a report on how much emphasis this current administration is putting on contracting out of services. And the bill this year is something like $400 billion for contracting out. And the tendency is to contract out rather than have government employees do things. There's a number of reasons for that, but the reason I pay attention to that is that one of my projects was to look at the Agency for International Development Libraries, and there was pressure for them to contract out their library service.
Oh.
And so one of the jobs I did was to look at that and kind of write a report on whether that made sense or not. And so it was going on in 1980 and and going on now with a vengeance. But I think the project I worked on of most long-lasting significance was the Output Measures for Public Libraries project that was contracted with a group led by the Baltimore County Public Library System. There were, I think, five different sponsors on it. That's all described in the beginning of the manual. But that was kind of down my alley because they were looking at the question of library effectiveness and what are indicators of library effectiveness. Mm-hmm. And there'd been a lot of thinking by library, public library directors about this issue. So there was some background to work with. And Joe Roger, who was also working at King Research, and I did that project of kind of developing measures, field testing those measures, preparing a manual of 12, we thought, relatively easy to use measures that could be used by public libraries to show levels of activity that had a service aspect to them, not internal activity of how many books that we shelved, but mm-hmm. Were people finding what they wanted, were they getting reference questions answered, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And that manual was a bestseller for ALA. Mm-hmm. I think they sold out at 10,000 copies, which is for ALA was the large run. And then there was a project that in 1987 produced a second edition that Nancy Van House was the lead author on, but I also worked on.
Mm-hmm.
My thinking on that project was that the initial measures were very crude and simple, and I thought that public librarians, having used those for a while, would start to say, these measures are really too simplistic, and we ought to do something better. There wasn't ever that pressure to go the next step. and at this point, I don't think those measures are being used very much, and librarians don't seem to be asking those questions. But for a while.
Why do you think that's the case? Do they not want
sure.
to know?
I'm not sure. Well, there was difficulty figuring out what to do with the answers.
Oh.
In some cases.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that was frustrating for libraries.
Mm-hmm.
And what would have been good would have been study groups or something like that to ponder these questions,
right.
Not just in staff meetings. But that didn't happen. And I think boredom set in. And they said, well, you know, we seem to be getting the same answer over and over, and we don't know what to do with it,
yeah.
That kind of thing. They're funny measures in the sense that, for example, the ones on materials availability, do people find out what they're looking for? People's expectations are built into that measure. So if the library's not been performing much, then their expectations are low, and they're going to find, you know, pretty much, because libraries will have the things,
sure.
They'll do pretty well. As the library starts doing better, people's expectations go up, and then they're more frustrated because the library doesn't meet all those.
Mm-hmm.
So there's kind of a joker in there. You can't really directly affect the outcome of that measure. It's kind of a collaborative measure.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that was kind of frustrating in terms of, because I know some library directors wanted to guarantee that they would produce a certain score. Well, you can't do that
mm-hmm.
with that measure.
How long did you stay with King Research?
2 years.
And were you just tired of it?
No, they ran out of money.
What year was that?
82. Oh, well, Reagan got elected.
Oh, okay.
And that made a huge difference.
Okay.
And they ran out of money. So for a while, or a few months in there, because academic positions are hired on an annual cycle, and the time they knew they ran out of money was December, which was the wrong time to start looking for a job.
Uh-huh.
So for a few months, I kind of pieced together some work. And
Consulting.
Mm-hmm. North Carolina had a project on continuing education for librarians. Mm. And they knew of my need for work, and so they insisted the winning contractor hire me to work on the project. So that
Very
gave
good.
Me some months of work.
Yeah.
And at the same time, there was a position available at University of Wisconsin. And I had talked with a friend before, you know, a year or more before, about what I might do after consulting, and I was hoping to work in a PhD program, and had looked around at the maybe dozen schools that offered PhD programs, and had selected Wisconsin as the one I wanted to work at, not knowing that there would be a real opportunity to turn up, so that turned
mm-hmm.
out to be fortunate. Jane Robbins had been hired in 81, I think, to come here, and Jane was kind of a sibling in that she was the first graduate, I think, of the Maryland program that Paul Wasserman and Mary Lee Bundy developed that was also based on social science approaches to information questions.
Mm-hmm.
And at one point, there was even some thought by Miles Martin that we might merge those two programs, the Maryland program and the Syracuse program. He was getting frustrated at Syracuse being slow to support his ideas. And so it made them very closely related, you know, programs. And I was the first graduate of the Syracuse program and was had met Jane during this. Mm-hmm. So we had that kind of background, although we didn't see a lot of each other in those intervening years. Mm-hmm. And I don't recall now who talked to whom first. But at any rate, Jane and I had a series of conversations because getting the college to approve the appointment or any appointment apparently took a lot longer than anybody thought it would. Mm-hmm. But to close the deal, I had to come make a campus visit. And even though she and I knew we wanted to do this, met the dean, Cronin, at that time. And
had you ever been to Madison before?
I had, actually.
Oh, okay.
I had done some work for the State Library in planning continuing education for librarians. Muriel Fuller had organized that, and there was a conference up at the, oh, what's it called? It's not called the Cloisters. It's a conference center in northern Wisconsin. Doesn't matter. At any rate, it was in, I think it was in December. So I had some experience of Madison.
Yes.
Jim Nelson was here. At that time.
He was the state librarian.
Yeah.
Right, yeah.
And I remember him telling me that it was more comfortable here once the lakes froze, and that was a strange concept to me. But I wasn't really familiar with Madison.
Mm-hmm.
But culturally, Wisconsin and Pennsylvania are very close because of the Germanic mm-hmm. background. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't feel like an unusual state to me.
So you came up here, you met the dean.
Came up and met the dean, mm-hmm. and he told Jane that I should be put up for tenure at the earliest opportunity.
Whoa.
But they had advertised for an assistant professor, so he mm-hmm. couldn't appoint me as an associate professor. But we were pleased by that.
Yes.
And I began teaching in the summer school in 1982. And taught a course in acquisitions, which was not, you know, my major area. But
did you and Jane talk about the fact that eventually you'd be moving into areas that you were more interested in? Or?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
The acquisition course was just a need for that summer.
Sure.
And I pretty quickly was teaching three required courses. There was the Library and Society course. We had a required research methods course and a management course. Mm. So I hadn't planned that,
yeah.
But that's how it worked out.
Mm-hmm. And then what were you working on then in terms of your research? Were you continuing in the public library use area?
Pretty much.
Uh-huh.
1982 was the year of publication of output measures. And so there was a lot of training and conference work that was going on about that, although the manual was expected to be kind of self-use, not require a seminar.
Mm-hmm.
But there was program interest. And also collecting some data on what were libraries finding. There was, as I was re-looking at my Vita, one of the papers that I was reminded of was a paper on or I guess it was the program that I was seeing. Why am I blanking on this? I looked. Here, in 1984, there was a PLA president's program on what some libraries are finding using output measures. And then in 90, we took over the publication of an annual report called the Public Library Data Service Annual Report that collected data from public libraries. It was on a volunteer basis, But because they were interested in the results, there was high interest among particularly larger public libraries in reporting the data. There would be some demographic data on the libraries in terms of size of staff and that kind of thing, but also the output measures that they were using. Number of new librarians added this year. I know one item of great interest was the director's salary. Hmm. And that report, I think, is continuing to be published by the Public Library Association. But we did it for 5 years here, mm-hmm. of mm-hmm. gathering the data from the libraries and producing a camera-ready copy for Public Library Association. Mm. So that was really more of a service thing than a research thing. It was really a database. We weren't doing research studies based on it. Mm-hmm. But that was one theme that kind of continued. Mm-hmm. Your questions ask about sources of funding. And yeah. one of the things that was going on in terms of library education was that the major and practically sole federal source of funding for library research was from the then Office of Education Library Programs Unit. And they moved, I think maybe in the late 70s, they stopped any programs that were simply open competitions for research, you know, submit your best ideas kind of thing, mm-hmm. and they moved to contracting, where they would tell you what they needed to have studied. Oh. And there really wasn't a source of funding where if you had a research track and a bright idea, you could mm-hmm. go to somebody and say, you know, I'd like to get some sure. support for this, mm-hmm. Unlike many other fields.
Right.
Not something generally appreciated by deans of letters and science.
Yeah.
And for a period of years, none of those contracts had gone to universities. And so in 87, it must have been, there was a RFP that came out for a study of adult literacy activities in libraries of all kinds. And Jane Robbins and I put together a proposal for that. And not because that was in our research stream, it was because we thought library education programs ought to be competitive in this process, mm-hmm. and not just to give it up. Mm-hmm. And we won that contract. Mm. And it was the first time a university had won a contract from that office in I don't know how many years.
Mm-hmm.
We subsequently got other contracts with that office, and I think the behavior is probably different now. I'm not sure, but that's my impression. But at that time, it was just a dry source mm-hmm. for funding.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a multi-year project. I'm not going to remember exactly how many years, but Jane Robbins and Deborah Johnson, who'd had a lot of experience in adult literacy programs, and I were on that and mm-hmm. developed a publication out of that, and also developed an evaluation manual for how to assess your program.
Mm-hmm.
It was kind of a, not similar to, but parallel to the adult output measures mm-hmm. kind of manual.
So was the, did you go up very early then for tenure?
Oh, yeah. Actually, Jane took him literally and put me up the first year,
uh-huh.
and he turned it down. And he
said
that he denied he'd put him up at the earliest opportunity.
No.
I actually asked him about that personally, and he wouldn't acknowledge he'd said that.
Oh,
so
gosh.
She put me up the second year, and
yeah.
that was okay. It was a characteristic of library education. One of the comments that the dean's office made, I don't know if it was the dean personally, was that all the letters of recommendation that were supporting my file were from people who knew me. And so he thought that was a criticism. Well, Jane's pointing out that in this arena, everybody knew me.
Yeah.
And, you know, so for the second go-round, Jane, oh, shoot, blanking on a name, a fellow who's the dean out of UCLA, first name Bob, not going to remember. At any rate, he had done a study of library productivity of library education people, and she asked him to write a letter for me. And his study had been of tenured people, so I wasn't included in that initial study. But to write a letter kind of comparing my record with the records that he was finding and so on, and to act like he didn't know me, because mm-hmm. he did know me,
yeah.
in spite of my not remembering his name at the moment. And so he did that, and that was part of the record. But it was kind of an irony
yes.
that it's a sign of how small a field it is. I mean, to have only a dozen PhD programs,
yeah.
That's a small pool of people.
Very
but,
interesting.
But they're used to, you know, having totally objective
sure.
folks from among the hundreds of schools.
Mm-hmm. Talk about your teaching. Mm-hmm. Did you enjoy teaching?
Sure.
You had a reputation of being a very good teacher.
Is that true?
Yeah, at least that's what I heard.
Okay, that's well.
Seriously,
I would expect you would know. Yeah, I did enjoy teaching. I enjoyed classroom interaction. I enjoyed doing something other than lecturing. Uh-huh. I developed a scheme for grading that I hit on at the University of Washington that was more achievement-based than score-based. Mm-hmm. That for me, I think, worked very well. I hit on this because I was teaching this management course at Washington, and they moved from a letter grading system to a numerical grading system. They were trying to cut back on grade inflation, as everybody does.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I knew that I shouldn't be grading exercises at a kind of a gross level, you know, A, B, C, and then averaging them out at the end, that I should have the same precision in the individual activities mm-hmm. that I do in the summary. So I started handing back papers with, you know, 3.4 or whatever, and I found I was spending a lot of time talking to students about why it's not a 3.6.
Oh dear.
And I didn't like that discussion.
Yeah, right.
So then I decided that I would start a policy of assignments and saying the requirement is the assignment is satisfactory. And if it's not satisfactory, that we could work with it till it is.
Okay.
I had some assignments in the course that were required assignments that everybody had to do. Mm-hmm. And then I had others that were optional assignments. And if they completed the required assignments satisfactorily, they would get a B in the course. And if they completed optional ones, they could raise their grade by half a grade, two optional mm-hmm. assignments, so mm-hmm. on. This was, I thought, somewhat subversive in terms of the operations of the university, but it changed the nature of the conversation with the students, and that was more important to me.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't have any quibbles about, you know, why it wasn't at this mm-hmm. kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And my role then was more of a promoter and a coach than it was an evaluator,
mm-hmm.
and I liked that better. In the management course, I used a group proposal writing exercise as a way of teaching management principles, and I think the group work worked better since they were working for this completion of a, you know, satisfactory
sure.
assignment. And we did quite a lot of feedback in that exercise. I had a proposal evaluation form that I'd gotten one time when I was an evaluator for the federal program, and we used that to give feedback, students giving feedback to other students and my giving feedback to them in terms of those criteria that were used in proposal evaluation.
Mm-hmm.
And that could be very threatening in a different grading scheme, but in our grading scheme, I think it worked pretty well.
Mm-hmm.
So I like that aspect of teaching. I would often regret that I'd made as many writing assignments as I did because I had to read them.
True.
And but one of the things I liked about my grading scheme was that in giving feedback, I could talk about the positive things that they'd done, and I didn't have to emphasize the negative things.
Mm-hmm.
Where in evaluation, if you're saying you're not getting an A, you have to explain why.
Right, right.
So, yeah, I like that. I like that part of teaching.
What about advising doctoral students? Did you enjoy that?
Yeah, I think that was probably, if I were evaluating, I'd say a favorite part.
And why is that?
Again, I was in the role of coach. And one-on-one, and relying on the motivations of students. And so when I think of the students that I remember most fondly, it's ones who came in with initiative, and then I'm helping them get where they want to go.
Why don't you talk about some of them? Where have some of your graduate students ended up?
Well, I wish I'd rehearsed a little about that. I mean, one that I think of is Ingrid Chayee, who's now at Catholic University. And Ingrid has got the abilities and the drive to be at a major university, but her husband's teaching at St. John's in Annapolis, I think, and that has limited her in terms of where she might locate. Mm-hmm. But she's continued with the research program, mm-hmm. and that's kind of a measure of how effective the right. PhD program is, since that's what it's about.
Sure.
Actually, a few years ago, we worked together putting together a proposal for that had to do with, I'm not going to reproduce the topic. At any rate, there was a RFP out there that you wanted to respond to, and so we got a chance to work together again on it, mm-hmm. and turned out not to be successful. One of the evaluators was aware that I was retired, thought that was disqualification. So, but it was good to see, you know, her position on campus there, the regard that she's held in, mm-hmm. And you know, the quality of work that she's still doing.
Mm-hmm.
Deb Johnson is a library consultant mm-hmm. In the area, and I just heard, because my wife has been reading the Janesville Gazette, that Deb's going to be interim director at Hedberg Public Library.
Oh, really?
Down in Janesville, because they've taken a long time to hire a new director.
Did you see?
You know, I've erased a lot of files in terms
of
front of mind here.
That's all right. Did you see a lot of changes in the students that came into the field while you were teaching and on the faculty?
It's a good question. I mean, I don't have a simple yes to that question.
Okay, that's all right. Would you talk about the culture of the department? Was it it sounds like it was collaborative.
Well, in part.
Uh-huh.
I mean, one of the things that Jane and I came into was a core faculty who had come almost 20 years before.
Mm-hmm.
Margaret Monroe had built a faculty in the mid-60s. And the majority were, maybe all of them, were still here. So they kind of had their own life, their own way of doing things.
Mm-hmm.
Jane and I came kind of from a different generation of training. Mm-hmm. And so Jane and I did a lot of collaborative work together and didn't give it much of a thought, but there wasn't a lot of collaboration either among the other faculty or with us and the other faculty.
Mm-hmm.
Toward the end of my time in the school, we bid on a project to evaluate a library power program, is what it was called. It was a program sponsored by the DeWitt Wallace Reader's Digest Fund that doesn't any longer exist in that form, but at that time, that's what it was called. They had put $45 million into a school library improvement program. And it was a multi-year program in 19 different sites where they would infuse quite a bit of money into the school system. And the notion was to make the school libraries much more central in the teaching program of the school. How to make that an active resource, not mm-hmm. a passive one down the hall that you go to mm-hmm. once a week to check out books. And I thought it was a very good program. I co-directed that with Diane Hopkins, who was also, I don't remember exactly when she came on the faculty, it was after my coming onto the faculty, and so she wasn't part of that core group, had been here for a long time. And she was the school library person, and so she provided that side of the expertise,
mm-hmm.
And I helped design the evaluation program. That was our largest project. That was a $2 million project.
Hmm. Talk about how the field changed while you were in it, the library information, librarianship, library services, library studies, information studies, et cetera. What does that reflect?
Oh, well, it changed in so many ways. I mean, one of the things that happened was this kind of library science, information science split, which doesn't make a lot of conceptual sense to me. It's I remember somebody was trying to define information science, and their definition was library science books stand up and information science books fall over. And it's because they were soft published, you know.
Yeah.
That was about as good an operational definition as they could come up with. But that split between library science and information science seems to have gotten worse over the years. And now you hear schools are described as I schools, and not L schools. And they're trying to kind of get away, because I think it's driven by money, but I don't know. I've not gotten the center of that, and I kind of observe it from a distance and think it's strange. Mm-hmm. But that's one change that's occurred. The change in media, of course, is huge. And I mean, libraries, you know, they have book kind of in the root of their word. Mm-hmm. So they kind of define themselves around books and how they organize books and how they understand books and promote books and so on. And then you have other media coming in that aren't really book-like. And what does that mean? And then we have the internet that comes along. Mm-hmm. And do we have to, in order to understand the internet, have to first learn reference works? You know, there's that kind mm-hmm. of ontology, recapitulating phylogeny stuff. So I think that it really is going to be needed for people to rethink what is this business about. I was just hearing about rural Oregon losing federal funding that they've been depending on for years, and suddenly library services are just disappearing. I don't think the communities are aware what they lose when they do that. Mm-hmm. Because I think they still are stuck with an old vision of libraries, and we haven't done a good job of giving them a different vision of what is that function in the community. The ALA posters that say read just don't get that message across.
Right.
And there is a general belief among people, you know, it kind of seems obvious that since you can find everything you want on the internet, what do you need libraries for anyway? Mm-hmm. And we haven't given good answers to that question. So those are huge changes that I don't think, I'm of course 5 years retired, so I'm not keeping track on this, but I'm not getting a sense either as a member of the public or as a casual observer of the library scene that we've developed good responses to that question. Mm-hmm. And yet you see Baker and Taylor and Borders bookstores doing very well, mm-hmm. Which is kind of an anomaly when you think, wait a minute, you know, what do we need these things for? Mm-hmm. I guess that would be something I would like to study if I were still studying, is who's using those, and I would guess they're also high library users. Mm-hmm. The high library users in the South Central Library System that are using their link catalog to get materials from all over this, I don't know how many county area, libraries are not irrelevant, but they haven't, in the popular mind, they haven't defined themselves mm-hmm. in a way that people have any kind of obvious response when you say, why are you paying taxes for libraries? Actually, a project that Jane Robbins and I did one time was to go around to small communities, and it turns out that Evansville, where I now live, was one of them. We went to a number of small communities and asked the city council members and library board members, and, you know, why do you fund your libraries? You know, you paid $250,000 last year for library services. Why did you do that? And we really didn't get good answers. They don't have good answers. And the last interview I had was in a northern Illinois town. I'm not going to remember the name of it now. And I was talking to a man, younger than I, man maybe in his 30s, about who was the chair of the finance committee of the council. And I asked him this question, and I'd warned him it was a tough one. I said, but why are you funding? And he said, you know, as chair of finance committee, I don't lack for information because people are trying to give me information all the time. Mm-hmm. But when I really want to know what's the right answer, you know, what's the unbiased answer, that's when I turn to the libraries. And he talked about his family's use of the library. Mm-hmm. And then he kind of looked up and said, it's a place to go when you want to know.
Huh.
I thought, okay.
Yeah, right.
You know, I mean, that's the image that mm-hmm. That we haven't really gotten across.
Yeah. It's as simple as that.
It is.
Right?
It is, yeah. And I was relieved to have somebody give me an answer.
Exactly.
It was, I don't know, 6 or 8 communities, I don't remember. And it was a stumper. They'd say, well, we think the phone would ring if we just cut the funding. You know, they weren't quite sure why.
Yeah.
And I've heard a lot from public officials who don't have any grasp of what that money is producing for the community.
Mm-hmm.
And they hear comments like, cows don't read, you know, why do we need to be providing library books, that kind of thing.
Yeah. And you're right, some of those council members are asking that question, probably.
Sure.
Yeah.
They ought to be. I mean, that's their job.
Exactly. And we better be able to answer it.
Which is, again, why that theme of library effectiveness is one that's kind of interested me. Is, you know, what difference does it make? What does it contribute to the community? Why is it cost effective
sure.
to spend that money?
What do you think are the most significant developments in librarianship? What have you seen to be the most significant developments?
Well, one that I was very cheered by when it was occurring was more of an emphasis on users, mm-hmm. and less on materials.
Mm-hmm.
And that was kind of really moving in the 70s and part of the 80s. I'm not sensing that going on now, so I'm less optimistic about that. It
mm-hmm.
seems to me that's still where the stress ought to be. The other movement, of course, is technology, and I've been very impressed with how adaptable librarians have been about that. I mentioned my aunt, who ended up in the reference department at Johns Hopkins in the mid 60s, and computers were just coming in, and she was terrified by this. I mean, this was not going to, you know, work for her at all. She was an example of a widespread shudder, I think, that went through the field. And I remember at ALA exhibits suddenly seeing monitors blossoming among the exhibits where a few years ago you wouldn't have seen one. And then everybody's got them. I've been impressed with the bibliographic instruction programs that General Library Systems mm-hmm. conducted, just as one example of really embracing this and championing it. And that's just been a huge development in libraries.
Mm-hmm.
I guess it would go back to my theme of I don't think we've explained that in a way that the public or the funders grasp what we're doing and why we're doing it,
mm-hmm.
why it makes sense, and why it's an integrated thing and not an add-on, and so on. That's the challenge, I think.
Mm-hmm. This question isn't on the list, but it's not a trick question. I'm just so curious. When you had your first job and you were looking at things that were happening around you, and you said, well, there's a lot of problems that I'd rather try to solve, which sounded a lot like management problems,
mm-hmm.
that you have to live with them for the rest of my life, and you taught management classes. What have you seen? Have you seen changes in library management? Have there been significant developments?
I can't point to changes that are a result of my work. I mean, one of the things I was trying to do, and I didn't stop to evaluate it, but as I look back on it, you know, I was trying with that proposal exercise to kind of teach a method for approaching problems
mm-hmm.
and communicating solutions to problems. that could be in the form of proposals, it could be in the form of five-year plans, it could be in the form of job applications, you know. That would be the first proposal that they probably would write after graduation was the job application. I don't know, I mean, I didn't get feedback that said from students, you know, I've really found this to be effective.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know that it made that difference. I think that if I were to point to a change, I think librarians generally are more self-conscious about management than they were. When I entered the field, there would be a personnel librarian in a major university library who would not be a librarian, and the library staff felt totally disconnected from, you know, that was a job that somebody had to do, but they didn't want anything to do with it.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's awareness now among library staff of what are the regulations involving, what can be asked in interviews, how do you evaluate staff,
mm-hmm.
You know, how you compensate. I think there's a more internalization of this
mm-hmm.
than there was at that time.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Talk about your service activities when you were on faculty. Were you involved in, I shouldn't ask it that way. Obviously, everybody has to be involved in committee work and.
Oh, yeah. I didn't do a lot of committee work on a campus level. A few things, but that wasn't the arena that I focused on, and I think this is, again, maybe a difficulty with library education, was the national and professional association arena, not internal in terms
mm-hmm.
of university.
Mm-hmm.
And that may be a problem in terms of our being seen as local citizens and being seen as effective by people on campus.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't hold offices in ELSA, the Library Science Association, but did quite a lot of committee work and conference, you know, programs. The Public Library Association was the one I related to most.
Mm-hmm.
And drawing the line between, you know, research and services in a practice profession
sure.
is harder.
Right.
So that if I was giving training on planning or training on output measures or something like that, which is that?
Yeah.
You know, it kind
right.
of relates to my mm-hmm. publication record, but it's really a service kind of activity.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the work that we did, The last major project that I did with Jane Robbins was one on evaluating library programs and services that was sponsored by the Department of Education Library Programs. And that was funded for 3 years. It was supposed to be a five-year project. And they have a habit of losing attention span after 3 years. They did that with a project called Performance Measures for Public Libraries that Ernie DeProspero at Rutgers had directed. And that was supposed to be a five-year project, and they funded the first 3 years, and the last two were dissemination and publication, and they just quit the funding. And so that project never had the impact that it could have had.
Mm-hmm.
And Output Measures leaned heavily on that work,
mm-hmm.
but it hadn't had the dissemination. And this project was a similar kind of one that was to develop an approach to evaluating library programs and services and telling your story, and we developed a planning model called Tell It, which was an acronym for talk about the vision, explore alternatives, talk about what's happening, and then talk about what happened, or learn from what's the L. It was a process and then a product, you know, and then the last two were kind of integrate the results of what you've learned into ongoing services and then think about the whole process and what you learned.
Mm-hmm.
And that I really see as a service, not as a research thing. It's an applied.
Mm-hmm.
But we were asked to develop a program that would help libraries tell their story. That's the way the tool was developed.
Mm-hmm.
And the last 2 years of dissemination, the office decided that they just needed to do something else. And
So it never got disseminated?
Not at the level that we'd had a couple training programs. We published a manual through ALA.
Oh, good.
That received some attention, but there was not the push.
Yeah.
So, yeah, you know, kind of, and I think you could research a number of fizzles like that that received a lot of attention. Even Library Power, which I think was a tremendously successful program and demonstrated just what school libraries could do in the educational program of schools and make a real difference in terms of schools. And about the time that we did the evaluation, the fund had difficulty working with the ALA office that was kind of their liaison with the field and providing the coordination and so on. And they knew they didn't want to keep working with that office. And they didn't have another office to work with. And then the stock market tanked, and the fund didn't have the funds. And it's one of the reasons they renamed the Reader's Digest Fund. And so far as I know, you know, I mean, I haven't actively looked for it, but I'm not getting any sense that that has been incorporated and has become, you know, business as usual in libraries. And the whole point of that was to do pilots in 19 communities and learn from that and integrate that in, as a standard practice.
That must really be frustrating.
It is.
Yeah.
I mean, particularly to look back, you know, on 20-some years of that kind of pattern.
Right.
Yeah.
And as far as it hasn't changed. Is there there even less funding available today than there, well,
I don't
today,
know.
But
I don't know about the levels of funding that are available. But when you were asking, you know, kind of long-term trend questions, I don't have the optimism I had when I started, when I saw some developments and saw some trends and thought these could really bloom.
Sure.
Well, they bloomed for a while and then they stopped blooming. And then, you know, attention goes to something else. And taking the long view, it's kind of hard to see that we're in a much better place than we were at the beginning. I mean, I think the difficulty of explaining library services and why they ought to be funded was there in the 60s, and it's here now.
Yeah, and we'll probably be here 30 more years.
And it strikes me as a solvable question. That's the frustrating thing. I don't see that there's anything in that question that's inherent that says you'll never be able to answer that question. But we haven't. And I think ALA's efforts, and I would look to ALA for leadership in this, and I think their efforts have been pretty lame.
Yeah. What is rewarding about association work? I mean, would you recommend to assistant professors first starting out that this is important, that these are things that you should be involved in? Or really,
well, it depends from what point of view, you know. I think it's important in a school, you know, like a library education program. I think it's important to stay as close to the client, which is the field, as you can. And that was one of the important things for me about staying in touch with the professional associations. And one of the things that I thought was very successful about the Output Measures project was that that was not seen as an academic thing that was forced on libraries, you know, done over here and supposed to be applied over there. But it was driven by the requests of library directors who wanted tools that they could use. And we had to establish credibility with them as being able to work on their problem. And so the association was valuable for that. There's a real gulf between the library education and the practice. And they're different cultures. And so that's where I would see the association work valuable. Personally, it's valuable because the national associations are where the energetic people gather. And so on the average, you get a better quality of interaction than you do in your local area where you don't have as many of those. So, you know, that was personally valuable for that. The question of strategically for an assistant professor. There's a real question about how much effort ought to be spent at that point. Mm-hmm. But then there's going to be the need to re-win credibility when you can,
uh-huh.
you know, when you have that security of the tenure position.
And then if you would talk a little bit about the publishing responsibilities of faculty. You started out as an English major, got a master's degree in English. Do you enjoy writing, and did you enjoy the publication responsibility that you had, publishing?
Yeah, I particularly enjoy it when it's going well.
Uh-huh.
I mean, sometimes it's a little like doing the dishes. You know, where you've had the fun in gathering the data or doing the project, and uh-huh. now it's documentation time, and that's not fun. But I did enjoy the communication aspect. I mean, one of the things, as I look back, I found that I would try to come up with titles that would kind of give a little wordplay or something like that. That report that I was talking about that was the first report on output measures used. I called it Measure for Measure. I wrote an article about that time. It's called Any Number Can Play. That was, you know, I found that kind of fun.
Mm-hmm.
The Tell-It manual was kind of fun, because it's trying to communicate, not just, you know, report on some activity, but trying to reach an audience, mm-hmm. and that was fun. And it's fun to do collaboratively. I mean, the Tell-It manual was had a number of authors, and so we'd kind of parsed it out or pieced it out, and then worked together on how this is going to work as a publication.
Mm-hmm.
I kind of enjoyed the publication process, and one of the things that I challenged myself to do with the Tell-It manual was to compose it on my Macintosh, and okay. so we sent Camaretti copy down to ALA for their publication.
Uh-huh.
I wanted to see, could the machine do it? Could I do it? Worked with their design people to get a layout. And so, yeah, I mean, you know, it's a mix.
Mm-hmm.
But I enjoyed trying to connect.
You mentioned about the fact that you sometimes wished you hadn't made so many writing assignments to your students.
Mm-hmm.
Did you have to teach your students how to write?
Well, I did give some instruction on it. I mean, I found most of the students could write an essay,
mm-hmm.
you know, so I didn't have to do anything terribly remedial about that. But I would talk to them about composition, and I remember there was a paragraph from a prep school that one of my college friends told me about. That, see if I can remember this now, that we'd give the beginnings of four sentences for a paragraph, and the first sentence would be beginning with what I want to say is, and then you fill in the blank,
mm-hmm.
and then the second sentence was that is to say, and you fill in that blank, and the third one was in for example, and the fourth one was in conclusion.
Ah.
and I would use that if I were stuck,
uh-huh.
and you know, what am I trying to do here. I would
right.
just, you know, fill in the end, and then eventually, of course, you remove the scaffolding from the beginnings of the sentences.
Yeah.
So that kind of thing, proposal writing, is a composition exercise.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'd talk a bit about that. So at that level, yeah, but not at the, having been an English teacher, and, you know, at New Hampshire, I was instructing in the English department, so there were some mechanics that I became familiar with that I,
mm-hmm.
my hand would automatically mark on, on pages. But again, with my grading scheme, I felt free to do that,
mm-hmm.
and not feel like they were going to, you know, be penalized for my pointing out that you really want to put the quotation mark outside the period.
Sure. Would you talk about any awards or honors that you've received over your career?
Not a lot of them. I mean, one of the things that I was glad about was being invited to Australia in 1986.
Oh, talk about that. That sounds interesting.
The folks in Australia are very much aware of their isolation. And as a result, ironically, are much less isolated than Americans who are not aware of their isolation. So the Australians work very hard. They have a standard program every 3 years of sending their workers abroad for a period of time to get in touch with what's going on. And the library conference makes a point of bringing people in. And I was brought in to be one of the keynote speakers at the conference in 1986. And it was because of output measures. And they wanted to get in touch with that, mm-hmm. what's going on. And while I was there, I taught in a library school. I'm trying to think now. I was there a total of 6 weeks. And I think I taught in the library school for three, and then toured giving workshops and so on for another 3 weeks. So that was really great, be given that attention.
Sure.
In that same year, I was invited to give a paper in Sweden. And so 86 was kind of a big year.
What was that paper on?
Well, there's a good question. It was related to output measures, I think.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
But it was a conference on library research, a Nordic conference, the kind of a regional, uh-huh. Like a Midwest federation. So there were people there from Finland, which seemed very exotic.
Yeah. Well, very good. The last couple of questions are personal, and I would like you to talk about your family. How did you balance work and family when you were here at on faculty? And then what do you do for fun and relaxation now that you're retired?
Okay, not a problem.
Okay.
While I was here, I was married to Karen Krieger, was her professional name. She's now taken my name now that she's also retired.
Uh-huh.
We didn't have children, so we didn't have some of the pressures of balancing home and work. And the fact that we were both in the library business also helped with integration.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't feel a particular tension about that. The tension we had was in finding two jobs that would work well together. And when she began as director of the what's now called the Hedberg Library in Janesville, for a period of years, well, she had worked at the Arrowhead Library System, also located in Janesville, for 2 years. And when she was there as the director, she was commuting daily to Janesville, which
from Madison,
mm-hmm. Middleton, actually.
Oh.
And so that was a very long commute. That mm-hmm. was not happy. And then the Janesville Public Library Board asked her to be a resident of Janesville. So we had an apartment there. And then for a couple of years, we shared the commute. And I would commute down a couple times a week, and she would commute up a couple times a week. And that was awkward
mm-hmm.
in terms of just being organized and, where is the fresh milk and
yeah.
that kind of thing. But it was fine, and Janesville is a fun community, so I didn't mind that commute at all. But after a couple of years, they agreed that she was integrated enough in the community that she didn't have to actually live there.
Oh.
She had become the first woman to join the Lions Club in the community and had done other things so that they felt that her residence in the community was not going to be necessary for her job.
Mm-hmm.
So then we looked for a place that we could share the commute in a different way,
mm-hmm.
but had the same house, and located outside of Evansville, which made a pretty equal commute
mm-hmm.
for us.
Mm-hmm. And that's where you live now?
That's where we live now, on a 40-acre property outside of Evansville.
Oh. So does that take up a little of your time in retirement?
Yeah. The property had been rented out for crops, but then we were kind of recruited to put the land in a crop reduction program because it's marginal farmland,
mm-hmm.
and we didn't buy it for the quality of the farmland.
Mm-hmm.
And they wanted to take it out of production because to get an adequate yield, they have to use chemicals on it. And it's also on a drainage for a creek and so on. So it's a good land to take out of production. So mm-hmm. it's now we have 32 acres of prairie.
Oh.
that we have to tend.
Yeah.
But that's our physical fitness exercise.
I see.
One of the things that I've been doing since I've been retired was getting involved with the organization that formed about the same time called the Evansville Community Partnership that I happen to be president of this year. This is my turn.
Mm-hmm.
And it's an organization committed to the improvement of the community that holds events like a chili cook-off. Now it's going to be its seventh year this year. And organizing the 4th of July festivities. Both are the fundraisers, and then the funds are pumped back into the community.
Mm-hmm.
That organization has made a huge difference in the quality of life, I think, in terms of the positive quality of life. There was some wrangling going on in Evansville that caused this organization to get going. The other thing that I've been involved with pretty heavily is community planning. There's a legislation in Wisconsin for smart growth planning in communities mm-hmm. that requires communities to actually have a plan registered with the state and then abide by it.
Mm-hmm.
And I was a member of the Evansville City Smart Growth Committee for 3 some years. And then we live in the town of Union that surrounds Evansville. And when they started their smart growth process, they asked me to chair that committee. And so I did that for about 2 years, and I'm now on the plan commission for the town of Union. And for both those planning projects, I did community surveys that were mailed surveys to households, random sample, and that information formed, you know, some of provided some of the information that formed the plans.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel good about that, you know, kind of being able to use the abilities that it developed in the university.
Sure. So that takes up. Do you travel?
Whenever we can.
Yeah. So where have you been lately?
Well, lately we were in France for a week.
Oh.
we had planned to take a cruise on the Lower Danube in November, and then it turned out the Lower Danube ran out of water, and so they canceled the cruise.
That happened to some friends of
Did
ours
it?
Were on that probably on that same
could have
been
the, same,
on the
cruise.
Same one, yeah.
So we rescheduled for a cruise in the lower Rhone River that went in through Provence
mm-hmm.
up to Lyon and did that in December.
And in December, but
yeah.
That was beautiful.
Well, yeah, I mean they pitch it as a Christmas market thing.
Uh-huh.
Actually, Christmas markets are a German phenomenon, but the French are kind of looking at this commercial opportunity.
I see.
And we didn't need to acquire more Christmas trinkets, but that was the timing of the cruise, and we enjoyed that. What Karen and I enjoy most is just on our own, traveling to a city and spending a week just in the city and wandering around.
Wonderful.
And the other thing which we enjoy quite a lot is Ireland, and we've been there 5 times and would go back in a minute.
Wonderful.
So, we do like to travel a lot.
Uh-huh. Do you use your public library?
Oh, yes. Karen calls me a library slut because I use multiple public libraries. I was on the Evansville Library Board and president for a period of time. But so much else was going on, and there were others that could do that, and so I'm no longer on the board, but I was in that library this morning, and I've been in 2 branches of Madison Public Library today, so I'm an equal opportunity library user.
Well, we've come to the end of the questions, but I don't want to turn the tape off until I ask you if there are other things that we should get on here before we end this interview. If there's some things that
it feels pretty comprehensive to me.
Okay. Well, I want to make sure. It was an excellent interview, and I really thank you for doing this. Really appreciate it. I think this is
glad
to.
You asked some good questions.
Well, I think this is going to be a great collection, having all of the SLIS faculty and as many staff as we could get, you know, being interviewed about the same time.
Well, they're questions we ought to be asking ourselves at other occasions than, you know, after you're all done.
Well,
But those conversations tend not to occur on a day-to-day basis, so I think it's a good thing to do.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you, Sandy.